Seminar. I'm not going to point any fingers, but I have to share with you North Dakotans that I met someone who told me, it was about a week and a half ago, that we had a frost, a light frost in the morning. You know, they went out to their car and they didn't know what was on their car. So this is important. Very important. So, all right, sorry, I just had to tell that story. We are in Exodus chapter 19 today. Some of you are like, whoa, fast forward, because you were here the last several weeks. We've been in Genesis, I think last, with Genesis 17, so we're just fast forwarding right ahead to Exodus 19. Now, it's interesting, one of our recent sermons, right? God met Abraham, and he told him in chapter 15 of Genesis, he said, in two verses, everything we just skipped. Your descendants, they're going to be slaves in a foreign land for 400 years, and then I'm going to lead them out. There you go. Now you're caught up. We're on Exodus 19. We're fast-forwarding across most of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and his sons, and Joseph's story. You may have seen the movies and all of the many-colored coat. We may talk a little bit about Joseph today. And anyway, but the main reason we're doing this is we're working toward a framework in which we can understand all of the Bible. Okay, that's why we're this whole series about our covenant God. How does God relate to us, his people? How has he related? And this chapter has been called by more than one scholar the most important chapter in all of the Bible. One guy said, if you don't understand this chapter, you can't understand the message of the Bible. Might be a little strong, but I understand his point. It is the prologue, the introduction. Some of us, you guys have read a book, right? And when you read a book and you open it up, and I used to do this for college, maybe probably before grad school, probably through college. You open the book and you see introduction, you go, I don't need that. You keep going, right? And somewhere in my academics, I learned that if I read the introduction, I'd get the point of most everything that followed it. And I'd been skipping this. And this is that. Chapter 19 of Exodus is the introduction to, well, the Ten Commandments is Exodus 20. And then the following, the rest of Exodus, all of Leviticus, and the first half of Numbers, okay, all takes place. It covers the time that the people of Israel are camped out at Mount Sinai. 11 months of 40 years is covered from Exodus chapter 19 through Numbers chapter 10. We don't know what they were doing the rest of the time. Got a little bit, but not much. Most of their 40 years wandering around in the wilderness is covered right here. And Exodus 19 is the introduction to all of that, which is mostly law. We talk about the books of the law and the code and the law. So that's what we'll be in. And I'm just going to read verses 1 through 8. And pray, and then kind of hopefully we can understand some of what this is about. 19:1. On the third new moon, after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, in modern English that says about 50 days after the people of Israel had gone out of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. And then Israel encamped before the mountain. While Moses went up to God, and the Lord called him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings, and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice, and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before him all these words that the Lord had commanded him. And all the people answered together and said, all that the Lord has spoken we will do. And Moses reported the words of the people to the Lord. Let me pray for it. God, thank you Thank you for your word. Thank you that we have it. Thank you that you've given it to us. That by your Spirit, you enlighten us, you open our hearts and our minds and our ears and our eyes. Jesus, you said, let he who has ears, let him hear. We pray that we will have ears today. It's in your name. Amen. All right. The first thing, and this is where I think it upsets some common assumptions that we have. Something I've said. Often in our circles, we might say things like, well, the Old Testament is about law and the rules, and the New Testament is about grace. But that's not what's going on here. That's not at all the point. The law hasn't been given yet. God didn't go into Egypt and give the people the law and say, if you can do this, then we'll talk about some plagues and do what it takes to get you out. That's not the way it worked. God's first thing he says to them is, I brought you out on wings of eagles. The image that's being used. These people, 50 days about, that they've been in the desert now. Now they're camped around the mountains, and probably they have seen this in their last month and a half. They've seen mama eagles teaching their baby eagles how to fly. And the way they would do that is they would shove them out so that they're helpless, weak, falling to their deaths. And then the eagles would swoop down and not grab them with their feet, but rather swoop underneath their babies and let them land on their back and then fly up. That's the image that God wants the people to understand, is that, look, you were helpless. You were stuck. You were hopelessly lost. And I swooped down under you with my power alone, and I brought you out. And then there's another thing about this. He's told them, right, when they were in Egypt, if you know this story, you know Moses shows up and they're like, who's this God you're talking about? And they have this whole long process of plagues. Maybe you saw one of the movies. But it's this long deal. And one of the things that keeps being repeated is, I'm going to take you, we're going to go into a land flowing with milk and honey. Often said over and over and over again, land flowing with milk and honey. The image is supposed to be conveyed is, well, it said, promised land, wealth, prosperity, freedom, goodness, it's all bounty. That's what's being described. And that promised land is over here. It's north. Just kind of go to the east a little ways, and then we'll go north. It's an 11-day walk, probably, 240 miles. A group of people could make it about a week and a half, 2 weeks, something like that. They could easily take the promised land. Of course, we know that they end up taking 40 years to get there. This is a month and a half later, so after they've left Egypt, and where are they? They're south. They're further from the promised land. God takes them the other direction. I mean, there's got to be something. In the wilderness of Sinai, it's drier, it's scarier, it's more lonely, there's less food there than there was in Egypt. They had it far better off in Egypt. God said, I'm going to take you out of Egypt, I'm going to take you into this wonderful land, which is over there, and he goes that way. And I think, on some level, that is a grace. That the desert, being in the desert in itself, is a grace of God. That he leads them there into this place. Think about it. So we might mention Joseph. Joseph, if you know his story, he's one of the guys we just fast-forwarded right past, with the many-colored coat. Read his story sometime. It's toward the end of Genesis. He was a jerk. I mean, this is what I love about this Bible. We think so often it's all about the good stuff. He came from incredible family dysfunction. His father had multiple wives, loved one more than the other. They were sisters, but he really didn't like this other one. In fact, the Bible even tells us she was ugly. And then it blames him, though. I mean, she's the one that comes out of this whole thing brokenhearted, and Jacob's got these issues. So, I mean, we've got this going on. He loves this one wife, so she has two sons. The other wife has several. He loves these sons more than he loves those sons. One of those sons that he loves is Joseph. And because of that, I mean, you can imagine what this does in a family system. He's got 11 brothers, and 10 of them are not, don't have the same mama. And so there's fighting. And he's just like all puffed up. He gets this special jacket and tells his brothers, oh, one day I'm going to be in charge. I mean, he's arrogant. He's a jerk. And what happens to him? His brothers sell him into slavery. He spends years as a slave. He goes to prison in Egypt for being falsely accused. He goes through all of this stuff. And toward the end of the story, he says, you meant it to his brothers, you meant all of this for evil, but God meant it for good. All the mess that Joseph went through ultimately was for his good. Now, the people, as you said, desert is a place of grace, a place where we grow. John Newton, the famous hymn writer, said one time, he said, nobody learns that they're a sinner from being told. We have to be shown. That's what causes growth, when we struggle and we face the reality of what we are, or maybe deal with some things that we wouldn't deal with outside of the desert. The ultimate example is Jesus. Hey guys, I'm going to bring in a new kingdom, all this stuff, right? All this stuff he says, and then he goes to the cross. You don't get the resurrection without the cross. This is the story, and this is that story. They don't go straight to the promised land. They go to the desert. And so let that be, I guess, an encouragement to some of us maybe that we're there now, or maybe we've been there, maybe we're headed there. The desert is a place of grace where God works in the brokenhearted. But we see the order here is grace first. Look at how it says in verse 4, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians. The first thing that we want to know is that they saw it. They know it. It was God that did this. And then the next thing they see is judgment. I did this to the Egyptians. And when you look at the plagues, which we're not going through and talking all about, but if you look at the plagues, they are very strategically set up to demonstrate that this God that we're dealing with, that's instituting the plagues, that's leading them out of Egypt, this God has authority and power over all of Egypt's gods. The Nile, all these gods that you think are powerful, Yahweh comes in and just drops the hammer on every single one of them. It's not to prove they don't exist. God could care less about that. It's to demonstrate his power over them. And you guys have heard me say this before, but I think sometimes we have that. We don't maybe put it that way, but our gods of self-pleasure or fulfillment or fame or whatever gods we have, this God doesn't want to debate with us whether they're real or not, because we feel their reality in us. What he wants to do is drop the hammer on those gods. And he tells the people in the desert, you saw that I did that. You saw it. And you know that you had every reason to feel that as the Egyptians did. But I brought you out. I brought you on wings of eagles. When you were helpless, when you were lost, when you were hopeless, I brought you where? To myself. This is really important. We sometimes, we think, you know, well, the point was to leave Egypt, right? To get out of the bad place. Maybe to get to the good place, but the point was to get from there to there. God says, no, 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 I brought you to me. One pastor I heard one time said something like, think about all of your imaginations of heaven. Everybody you ever loved is there. You know, angels with harps. Whatever, the goodness, the flowing with milk and honey, whatever that good, wonderful stuff is, what you imagine it, but God's not there. Is it still heaven? It's not. It shouldn't be. Because without God, there's just no point. And here we have God says, I brought you to me. Which ultimately is the highest thing. That's the relationship that was broken way back in the beginning when they ate the fruit. That's what was corrupted. And God says, I healed that. It's done. You couldn't help it. You were helpless. You were falling to the ground like a rock, like a baby eagle. You were stuck in Egypt, and I brought you out to me. Think about it. We in our circles, we love testimonies, right? We like stories. We tell stories. This is how God saved me, right? Think about an ancient Israelite. Think about one of these people, one of these guys wandering around the desert. What's his story? Well, I was a slave in a foreign land, and God brought me out. Under the blood of the Lamb, Passover, I hid by God's grace. He brought me out of that, and now I'm on my way to the promised land. I'm on my way to a place where I will dwell with him forever. That doesn't sound that different from our story. We sometimes think it is. It's not. I brought out in order to be different. And that's the next things that come. If you, see, this is what's now. There's a now here. Where is it? Verse 5, I did this. I bore you on eagle's wings. I brought you to myself. Still, you haven't done nothing. Now, if you will if you will obey my voice and keep my covenant. Let's think about it. Obey. We often look at the Ten Commandments. And we think these are the things I'm supposed to do. And that does. It sums up, the law or whatever. We think. Now, there's two ways that we, I think, are motivated to obey the Ten Commandments. One is, God is going to get me if I don't. Or maybe give me stuff if I do. Maybe heaven. I get to heaven if I do this right. Or I get this thing or I don't get that. Whatever that is. That's about us. That is selfish obedience. The other is, I love God and what he's done for me, and so I want to honor him. I want to love him. I heard one person explain it this way. When you fall in love with someone, some of you know what I'm talking about, you think about what's going to make them happy, and you do it. You might be where to eat. It might be a little surprise or a little note on a windshield. These are the kinds of things we do at this stage in our relationships, some of us. That might go away. Kids come. Stuff like that happens. But that's what we do. What are we doing? Think about this. You wouldn't use these words, but when you say it this way, yeah, you are doing the will of the beloved. Why? Because you want to please them. That's the only why. That's why. You want to make them happy, so you do what they want. That's a God-motivated reason to obey the Ten Commandments. See, God doesn't say, now, okay, you got to earn this thing. He says, it's here. I've made this covenant. Obey me. Sometimes we think about it. If we fail to obey, we know the kinds of things we want to do. We mess up, whatever. We think things like, I don't love God enough. I'm not good enough. I don't know enough. This is what's causing me to struggle. I need to be fixed. Or maybe we're thinking they need to be fixed. But the problem is here. And I would suggest another phrase that might help better, might help us grasp this a little different way and say, God's grace has not penetrated my heart deeply enough yet. That if it does, I might be captivated and want to do the will of the Beloved. That's what God has in mind here when he does this. If you will obey me, if you will keep my covenant, and then we have these blessings. The blessings are not heaven. If you will keep my covenant, you will be my treasured possession. You will be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. If you will keep my covenant, what does that imply? It's already established. It's not based on their obedience. The covenant is not based on their obedience. It is here. How many marriages, and don't raise your hand, how many marriages are not enjoyed as fully as they could be because we're so bullheaded? The covenant is there, right? The covenant exists. It's not going anywhere. The problem is we're not enjoying it as well as much as we could. These are the blessings of the covenant. These are the blessings that we get from obedience, is experiencing what is already ours. You will be to me a treasured possession. That's that word. I had this tattooed on my arm because the word itself has this deep meaning, okay? It means the king, back in this day, the king owns everything. I mean, he owns everything in your house. He owns everything in my house. He owns the cattle. If it's within his borders, it belongs to him. So do you, okay? But he also has something that he just treasures and he loves. And he takes that thing and he sits it on his dresser and he looks at it and he enjoys it. That's that word. The thing that belongs to in the king's home, that's what that is. You will be this. Now, here's the thing. Obviously, they already are. He went out and brought them out of slavery. He parted water to get them. He turned a river to blood. He did this to get these people. He obviously already treasures them. What's the problem with that? Do we feel it? Do we want to feel it? Do we want to experience being the treasure of the king? Or do we want to always kind of wonder, does God really love me? He does. Our wonderings are not God's fault. They're ours. Because we struggle with obedience. We struggle. God's love doesn't change. He doesn't change from treasuring us. But we don't always experience that. If we want to experience being treasured, all we need to do is obey. Will we do that? The other thing, kingdom of priests. A priest is the mediator, the one that goes between God and man. The whole point. Now, if we think back, this is essential, because if we think back to Genesis chapter 12, and we'll see this theme repeated over and over and over again as we go. In Genesis 12, God said to Abram, I'm going to bless you, make you a nation of many, so that the nations, the whole world, will be blessed through you. This is what this is about. Israel was never, even here at the desert, the mountain in the desert, the point is not that they would, you know, oh, we're God's people now, ha ha, we got that and you don't. The point was always to establish a nation that would mediate between God and the world. To be a place where people could know God. A kingdom of priests means you will be a nation of people who bring people to me and me to people, that mediates between me and the world. It's interesting that Peter, in the New Testament, picks up this very same verse and quotes it almost verbatim, talking about you and I, the church, mission of God. So many of us, I think, go through life and our mission is self-satisfaction, fulfillment. Who dies with the most toys wins. This is what we often become about. And God is offering to us a mission, a purpose that goes far beyond whatever years we'll get here, that matters into eternity. God says, if you just obey me, you get to matter forever. That's a blessing. And it's a blessing that sadly a lot of us don't participate in. We get to be a part of what he's doing in the world. We get to know God and make him known. And we get to be a holy nation. Distinct. Holy, it has come to mean morally pure. That's not really what it initially, that's not the root, that's not what it means. It means distinct, set apart, different, unique. It came to mean morally pure, partly because obedience to God sets us apart, often as morally pure. But that's not what it's supposed to be. It means different. Think about it. If the church in America were truly different, like way different from our culture, and by the way, we're becoming more that way. I think the last 50 years or so is easy to kind of just look like everybody else. That's changing. But that's a good thing, to be different. We sometimes think, I don't want to be different. I want to be like everybody else. But who wants, guys, you want to go marry a woman that's just like everybody else? Ladies, you want a man that's just plain? God says you can be different. You can stand out. You can be to me a treasured possession, a kingdom of priests, and a holy nation. One of the ways we're different is by when the gospel grabs a hold of us, when we get that we can never earn it, we're not good enough, we never will, they never could, and they knew it, and yet God brings us to himself, it sort of works on us, you know? We realize we're not as important as we like to think we are. It sort of makes us a little more humble. Imagine a room full of people who, humility has been described as, they don't think less of themselves, they think of themselves less. Imagine a room full of people who just think of ourselves less. It's not that we think we're bad, we just aren't really more important than anybody else. Wow, what can that group of people accomplish? I'd say just about anything. But the gospel starts that work, chipping away at our egos so that we can be that. Nothing changes. That's the Old Testament, the way it used to be, right? Everything was by grace. And the obedience earned blessings. It's true in every area. Think about obedience in the area of our sexuality. Leads to wholeness. We feel better. We will have a better life overall if we obey in that area. It's not about punishment or because God doesn't like us to have fun. It's because he wants us to have as much fun as we possibly can. And he gave us this gift. It's about community. I get these phone calls, you know, a lot that are, you know, I have this need in my life. My first question is, do you have a church? Because I've seen here when needs come up in people's lives that the church meets those needs. I've seen families surrounded in prayer because of obedience, because they were obedient to be in a Bible community. They were here in community, and when need hits them in the face, when the desert wilderness draws them out, they are surrounded by people who love them. That's a blessing from obedience. It works in every area. Prayer. I don't like to pray. You get God. I know. It's hard. But obedience leads to fulfillment. It is not the other way around. It is obedience doesn't earn us any chips with God. It gives us more of God. That's what it's for. God's grace alone saves us. But obedience enters us into relationship with Him that we were made for. Let me pray. God, thank you for the law. Thank you for this chapter, these verses. Thank you for grace. Pray that we will experience it, sense it, and see it in every page, in every breath, in everything that we do. It's in your name. Amen.